Yeah, what's up? It's your boy Joel Ortiz, and I want everybody to make sure that they subscribe and download the podcast, Library Rap, the hip hop interviews with Tim Einenko. Yo, Tim, I hope all is well. You my guy. I know these interviews are not interviews, they're actually conversations, and I appreciate them all. Yeah.
Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Ice-T. I want you to do something for me. Make sure you download and subscribe Library Rap, the hip hop interviews with Tim Einenko. It is official. All right, stop playing. Download and subscribe. Library Rap, the hip hop interviews with Tim Einenko. It's cold. Check.
Journalist, author, hip-hop historian just released his latest book, From the Streets of Shaolin, The Wu-Tang Saga. Skid Fernando, welcome to Library Rap, the hip-hop interviews with Tim Einenko. Thank you so much for being here.
Respect, Tim. Thanks for having me.
So I want to start from the beginning of the book, but the first chapter of your book. And you're telling the story of Wu-Tang, but you start off with a much earlier date, and that's August 11, 1973. Why did you decide to start on this date and kind of like retell the story of the birth of hip-hop?
I think it's important to understand, first of all, you know, where hip-hop came from, and it's humble origins, you know. So August 11, 1973, is kind of the date that a lot of hip-hop historians agree upon as like being the first date that it was definitely the first day that Kool Herc threw his first party in the Bronx at 1520 Sedgwick Ave. And that kind of marks the birth of the art form, because that's when he debuted, you know, this new thing that he had kind of come up with called breakbeats. And you know, I'm not going to retell that story again here, because it's in the book and it's pretty well documented. But you know, there was a lot of DJs at the time. There's a lot of people kind of talking over records at the time. You know, this is not like something new. But what Herc brought to the table was the breakbeat, and that's so important for the history and evolution of hip hop. You know, because he was basically isolating the climax of the song, you know, where the rhythm went crazy, and he was going back and forth on the turn. He was getting two copies of the same record and going back and forth between the turntables, basically making an extended mix of that. And because you know that what that allowed was people to actually start rhyming over the beat, and to me, that's the birth of hip hop, because you know you have people rapping over records as far back as Pigmeat Markham. You know, Here Come the Judge, and even way before that, you could, you know, in my first book, The New Beats, Exploring the Music, Culture, and Attitudes of Hip Hop, which came out in 1994, I go into all of that stuff. You know, I go into the African griots, you know, I go into the Last Poets and all of the predecessors, the forerunners of hip hop. So rapping in itself has been around, but what Kool Herc brought to the table was rapping over beats. And the reason I wanted to recap that era of hip hop is, you know, because now hip hop is basically pop music, you know, and it's a global phenomenon and it's very commercial. And you know, people kind of forget where it came from, you know, and it really came from the Bronx, this really impoverished neighborhood in New York City. And it's amazing. It's still amazing to me that it just spread out from there, and it spread like wildfire. And if not for this man, Kool Herc, and his MC Coke LaRock, you know, we wouldn't be talking about this right now. And to me, Wu-Tang represents the bridge between that era, the old school era, and what is happening now, you know. And to me, Wu-Tang was like the was not the first Renaissance, but was one of the they came in with the Renaissance of hip hop, you know, a rebirth of hip hop, a rebirth of that original concept. I would say that Run DMC was probably the first Renaissance of hip hop, you know, from the old school era of, you know, Grandmaster Flash and Cold Crush, where it was more about kind of routines and rapping over disco breaks and you know, Run DMC brought in the first Renaissance of hip hop. It's just like, they basically just brought in the straight beats and straight lyrics over beats. And they changed the style too. It was more like, you know, they dressed like drug dealers. They dressed like street dudes compared to like, you know, Grandmaster Flash and them and Melly Mel, who were like, you know, entertainers. They were more into the showmanship of it, you know, wearing these outfits and like crazy, you know, like Daniel Boone caps and leathers and Bally's and shit like that. You know, Run DMC kind of brought in the first Renaissance of the stripped down beats and the leather jackets and Adidas, you know, looking like the drug dealers on their block. And then Wu-Tang, you know, brought in the next Renaissance of hip hop. And it was a powerful Renaissance in the 90s, because in the early 90s, you had the major labels taking over rap. And that's when we got phenomenon like Vanilla Ice, you know, and Ice Ice Baby and MC Hammer and Young MC. This was like pop rap, you know. It was necessary because, you know, that was when rap was on the top of the charts and selling platinum records, and it broke through into the mainstream, but it wasn't reflecting the culture, you know. There's hip hop culture and then there's rap music, you know, and you know, you got to distinguish between the two. So to me, I had to recap that old school era just to put people in the mindset of, look, this is where it came from. You know, it might be pop music now, but this was underground shit. You know, this was like only people in this neighborhood knew about this shit back then. And actually, Wu-Tang had a connection to the Bronx, to the South Bronx, because GZA, who's like the elder dude in Wu-Tang, you know, his father used to live in Soundview Projects. So when GZA was just like a tween, when he was like 11, 12, 13, he was exposed to all that original hip hop that was going on in the Bronx. And then eventually he brings his cousin Robert Diggs and exposes him to it. And Robert Diggs, who became the RZA, he was, you know, that changed his life, you know. And then they introduced their other cousin, Rusty Jones, Russell Tyrone Jones, who became Old Dirty Bastard. So I think it's important to connect these guys to the source, you know, because they saw what was going down. They were kids and they were influenced by it, and they basically updated the original formula of hip hop to a new era in the 90s. And now we know, you know, the 90s is another kind of formative period in hip hop, the boom bap era. You know, people call it the golden age of hip hop, even though when I was coming up, the golden age to me was like 86 to 88, you know, when you had like Eric B and Rakim, KRS-One, Public Enemy, EPMD. To me, that was like the first golden age. And to me, the 90s is like the second golden age. So,
And because I want to go back to, actually, I want to go back to 93, right? You write, quote, "Everything from New York's Forbidden Borough, the original Nine Man Collective, hits kids like a Scud missile with Enter the Wu-Tang, 36 Chambers." Take us back to 93. What did you know about Staten Island's hip hop scene at the time? I mean, what did you end up learning about it that maybe you just weren't familiar with? And then how long do you think, you know, we always talk about like Artifact, you know, like Elder Sensei from the Artifacts talked about, and I know different state, but you know, he talked about how like when they used to come to New York, they used to hide the fact that they were from Jersey, right? Uh-huh. Was that kind of the same deal and with Wu-Tang having to hide, did they ever have to hide the fact that they were from Staten Island? I mean, were they worried that how that would be, you know, the forgotten borough is like taking hip hop by storm?
Yeah, well, that's an important point. Yeah, because in that time, Staten Island was pretty much non-existent. You know, Staten Island as a borough was persona non grata in hip hop. No one gave Staten Island props. You go to parties, and you know the DJ, whoever was DJing back then, would be, "Yo, is Brooklyn in the house? You know, Queens in the house? Boogie Down Bronx, Manhattan." You know, all the boroughs were represented. No one ever said Staten Island, man. Right. You know, it's like, it was almost like a joke. And, you know, when I talked to the individual members of Wu-Tang, like especially Raekwon, he was like, you know, Staten Island got no respect. And that was a big issue for them, because they used to go to these parties too. You know, they used to go to Latin Quarter and the Red Zone and stuff like that. And imagine like, And you know, Staten Island was well represented in those parties too, because like he said like 100 dudes used to take the ferry over when they were teenagers to go to like the Red Zone and Latin Quarter, Union Square, all these you know, hip hop venues that were formative, but obviously they're not around anymore. And imagine like 100 dudes from Staten Island are at the party and they don't hear the DJ shouting out their borough. You know, so that they got a chip on their shoulder already. So I think that was really important to them at the time. And, you know, I had moved out to New York in 91. And, you know, one of the first things that I did when I moved to New York was just go to the South Bronx and just walk around, you know, just like kind of get lost and walk around just to get the feel of the neighborhood and to feel what the streets were like. Cause to me, that was like Oz, you know, cause I had heard about the South Bronx and all these records, you know, but to actually see it and feel it was like a whole different thing. And, you know, eventually I made it out to Queens. I made it out to Brooklyn. You know what? I never bothered to get on the ferry and go out to Staten Island, because what the hell was in Staten Island? You know, it had the reputation back then of just being a place where the mob lived, you know, and like in a big Italian neighborhood. And, you know, I had no desire to go out there, you know? So that was really the case back then, you know, like Staten Island. You know, now we know, knowing our history, that like the Force MDs came from out there, but they were, even though they started out hip hop, they went more into R&B. And one group that was representing Staten Island at the time, which was like 91, 92, was the UMCs. I don't know if you remember that group. I think they were signed to Jive, and they were more of like a, kind of more of a kind of a poppy group, even though those guys knew Wu-Tang at the time. They knew RZA and them, and you know, RZA shouts them out and everything, but they weren't you know, they didn't really play up the Staten Island roots either, you know. So I can totally see why El DeSensei and those guys from Jersey would be like that too, because you know, Jersey wasn't getting that kind of respect either until probably Naughty by Nature broke through, you know? And then you had like Poor Righteous Teachers, you had Apache, you had the whole Flavor Unit was pretty much from Jersey, you know, like Kim Shabazz and all those people, Queen Latifah. But that was very important back then, where you came from. And obviously Brooklyn got the most respect, you know, because Brooklyn was pretty hard back then, you know, like you went to parties and it was always Brooklyn who was acting up and starting fights and stuff like that, you know. And Queens obviously has, you know, Run DMC, LL Cool J, Marley Marl and the Juice Crew. So they were well represented. And, it really took Wu-Tang to put Staten Island on the map. And, you know, I talk about that first, their record release party at Webster Hall in Manhattan. And no one even really at the time, even though Protect Your Neck had been been banging in New York for about a year. No one really kind of knew what the Wu-Tang looked like. And then you show up at this record release party and there's like there's freaking 100 dudes on stage. So, you know, they brought half a Park Hill with them. They brought half a Stapleton with them. And you still didn't know who was in the group until people started rhyming, you know? So that's how hungry Staten Island was at the time. You know, it's like RZA talks about it. You know, it's like he felt like these guys were in the dungeon and then they finally got let loose and, you know, they just came out with all this energy and power, you know, and they made people know who Staten Island was after that, you know, Shaolin.
You know, you write about how each of the members had this incredible entrepreneurial spirit and, you know, in each of them, right? And from like as kids to obviously you see them now till now. But what is it about the Wu-Tang story being a Wu-Tang, the group, and it was being birthed out of Staten Island versus the other boroughs that makes this story particularly so special in regards to a New York story, but also a hip hop story?
I think because of the geography of the place, Staten Island is an island, you know, and as an island, they're kind of isolated, you know, to their credit, all the guys in Wu-Tang used to leave Staten Island a lot, you know? So like, especially RZA, he was all over town. He was in the Bronx. He was in Brooklyn. He spent enough time in Times Square watching all the Kung Fu flicks and stuff. And the same thing with the other guys in their era, because there was really nothing going on in Staten Island. There were no parties there except like house parties. They had to travel to experience hip hop. Okay. So they had to go to the other boroughs, experience hip hop, and then they brought it back to Staten Island. And because Staten Island was so isolated, they kind of developed hip hop, you know, amongst themselves. And it kind of grew and developed. It's like when I went to Cuba, I recently went to Cuba, you know, and when you go to Cuba, one of the things that Cuba is famous for, Havana, is like all these American cars from the 1950s. And it's amazing that they have all these cars there from the 50s. But if you know the history of Cuba and everything, when the embargo and the blockade started, that was like right during the 50s. So basically after the 50s, everything got shut off and there was no other type of cars coming in. And it's kind of the same thing with Staten Island. You know, it's kind of like the first time I went out there, it was like going back in time. You know, it's like everything is kind of a throwback in Staten Island. It's almost like suburban in a way, but everything is well preserved there. And like time kind of stands still, you know? So I think that is really important, because even though the Wu-Tang guys were getting influenced by stuff that was going on in other boroughs, they brought it back to Staten Island and they had time to work on their craft, which was rhyming, emceeing, which was making beats. They had time to work on that craft for years without any disturbance, you know? And it's just like, I think RZA said in his book, it's like, you know, it's like King Kong, you know, could only have developed on an island because there's no other influences, you know. And so King Kong grew. And it's like the same thing with Staten Island. Because it's isolated and because you have to really make an effort to get there, there's not a lot of things coming in. So these guys, even though they were influenced by hip hop, they had that time and space to develop their craft amongst themselves, you know, and that was so important because they were neighborhood stars before any of us ever knew about them, you know, and that was so important because a lot of groups in hip hop, you know, they hip hop is a young person's game, and a lot of these guys are teenagers when they get into it, and they'll get signed to a major and put out an album, and then that's like the last you hear about them, you know. But Wu-Tang had time to just learn and grow and develop. And, you know, RZA probably had like tons of beats by the time, you know, Wu-Tang matured and got signed to a label. So that's why in the years following that, you know, we had so many different albums coming from this man. You know, we had like, you know, Method's album, ODB's album, Raekwon's album, Jizz's album, and they all sound different because RZA is sitting on all this material that he's been developing for years, and he's been developing his style for years. And the same thing with the MCs, you know, they were developing their styles, and the only people that they had to go up against was themselves. So it was like steel sharpened steel, you know, they were competing against themselves. And they reached such a high level of lyricism. And, you know, when it was finally time to birth the Wu-Tang, we were all just blown away by what they had because of that island mentality and because of the time and the years that they spent perfecting their craft.
Ghostface spits on the opening track of Bring the Ruckus off Wu-Tang's debut album. Ghostface cast a blast of
my clock burst, leaving a hearse. I did burst. I come rough, jump like an elephant tusk. Your head rush, fly like Egyptian musk. Oh shit, Wu-Tang clans bought the wicks.
And you think about the members of this group, and you know, there's nine of them, right? So you imagine that any of these members could be, you know, could have started off the track, the opening track of their album. What's this for you? What's the significance of Ghostface doing so?
Well, I think, that is kind of surprising because, first of all, it's a dope ass verse.
Yeah.
Shit, let's give it up for Ghost. That's like, but, I think at the time, you know, RZA and Ghost were roommates at the time, so they were probably the most closely connected. That's why on the original B-side of Protect Your Neck, you have After the Laughter, you know, because that's a RZA and Ghost track. And they had actually recorded that on their own. And, you know, obviously RZA used to do tracks with all the individual members, but because he was roommates with Ghost for that time, for that period right before they got the deal, you know, RZA had gone out of town for a minute to Steubenville, Ohio, and then he got into trouble out there. And after he beat his case, he came back to New York, and the first place that he moved back to was Stapleton Projects, which is, that's Ghost country. You know, Ghost grew up in Stapleton. He's the only member of the clan from Stapleton. And so RZA and Ghost were pretty much roommates living in Stapleton. You know, there was a bunch of other guys living there. Bourne, who was RZA's younger brother, was living there. I think Divine was locked up at the time. But those were like, those were hard times. Those were really hard times, you know, right before they got the deal. And pretty much they were living on oodles and noodles and, you know, just watching kung fu flicks and smoking blunts and making beats. So I think RZA and Ghost had a special chemistry during that time, even more so than the cousins, you know, because GZA and ODB were in Brooklyn at the time, you know, doing their thing. So they didn't have that daily connection with RZA like Ghost did. So I think that's why Ghost starts off that track. And probably also, you know, he had the best verse. He had the best opening verse to kick it off. Cause like I said, there was a lot of competition on that first album for verses. And you can hear it on that whole first album. Dudes are rhyming like their life depended on it, mm-hmm. You know, and it really did, because at the time, a lot of them were all involved in the street game and they did not want to be, you know, they really did not want to be. as much as people glorify the street life and dealing crack and all that shit, even, you know, even Raekwon, I was lucky enough to read Raekwon's book, which is coming out in November of this year. It's called From Staircase to Stage. And I wrote a little blurb for the back of that. And even Raekwon, you know, he was like desperate to get out of that, you know. No one, I mean, who would want to be in that game? You right. know, it's like you're getting people getting locked up, people getting shot, people getting killed. That's nothing to be involved with. So even though from the outside it seems like rap glorifies that whole crack era, to me they don't. You know, it's like they're telling you a deep story about it, but they don't want to be involved in that, you know? And so just getting back to your question, I think that's why Ghost kicks it off, because he had the dopest verse, and also he had this closest connection with RZA at the time, because they were roommates and they were living together and they were probably doing shit daily, you know, working on shit daily. So
You know, you think about each member of the group, and you know, as a kid listening to them, there's obviously a different impression you have of them, but then you get older and you learn more about them and you kind of realize how geniuses they are. And I want to ask you about ODB, because you know, as I remember, you know, as a kid watching him, and you know, this is when, you know, MTV played music videos, right? I was exposed to him as, so I guess I was probably like 12 at the time, as like the quote unquote silly one, the crazy one, right? And then you get older, and then you kind of learn more about the addictions that he was dealing with at the time, and kind of how, you know, it takes you aback and kind of sad, and you know that he was portrayed this way. But then reading your book, what's great is that you talk about how he's just like, this is kind of musical, like, sponge, right? I think you call him a musical sponge, where his like influences are his Uncle Fred dancing, you know, to kind of the Beatles, the Marvin Gaye, and all this stuff. Can you talk about how and why ODB worked so well within this group?
Well, to me, and I think if you ask the individual members of the Klan, I think ODB was like the heart and soul of Wu-Tang. I think if you had to have one member who represented the whole Wu-Tang and what they stand for, it would be Old Dirty Bastard, you know. And he was crazy before he got into substances, you know. He was crazy from birth, you know. If you talk to his family, I spoke a lot to his older brother Ramsey Jones, who's a very cool cat, and you know, he gave me a lot of perspective on ODB growing up. And ODB's mother, Miss Cherry Jones, was also a great source for this book, as far as, you know, what ODB was like as a kid. And, you know, he was just one of those dudes. He was just, you know, and I think the reason that he resonates with so many people is that he's a free spirit, you know, and you don't find too many people like that in the world today, you know. So everyone's got to appreciate a person like that, who's honestly just free, you know, who just does what they want, says what they want. He's never out to hurt other people. The only person he really hurt was himself in the end, you know. But you know, he was always the guy. Even when you look at old Wu-Tang footage on YouTube and stuff like that, from even like before they were signed, there's some really great stuff on YouTube of like ODB beatboxing for RZA and stuff like that. And you know, also, The funny thing about ODB is, as ghetto as he kind of portrayed himself, he was also the guy who probably had the most normal family life, you know, which I kind of go into in the book. He was one of the only dudes who came from a two-parent family, you know, where both his parents worked, you know, even though they were on public assistance for part of the time, both his parents were, you know, worked. You know, he had all his brothers and sisters, you know, he had brothers and sisters. It seemed like a really good family life, you know. And Mr. William Jones Sr. was a huge music aficionado. And he was not only into black music, he was not only into soul, jazz, and R&B, but like I said, he was into the Beatles, he was into Hendrix. And he introduced Ramsey, who's the oldest child in the family, he introduced Ramsey to all this music. And you know how it is, like, in my family, there's three people. I got an older brother and sister, and it was my older brother, Sid, who really set the tone for music in my family. Anything that he listened to, we all listened to. So I can totally see how in ODB's family, it was Ramsey Jones who was bringing back all these records. And Ramsey was influenced by his father, you know. And, you know, Mrs. Jones was a amazing singer in her own right, you know. And she was almost signed to Columbia as a teenager, but she came from a very conservative family, a church-going family. And, you know, her mother wouldn't have it, you know, so, but yet they grew up in this musical household, you know, they were singing church songs. And then, you know, you had the influence of Mr. Jones Sr. Then you had the influence of Ramsey Jones, who was the first kid in the family to go out to Greenwich Village and go to all those record stores that they used to have back in the day, like Bleecker Bob's and stuff like that, and bring back stuff. So imagine ODB exposed to all of this stuff, you know, and he's the guy, he's like the class clown in his family. So even though like all his family was like musically oriented and musically talented, and, you know, Ramsey is still an amazing professional musician. He's in a few groups. And I saw him recently, you know, before COVID, I saw him backing up his cousin GZA with a live band. And that was amazing. They did Liquid Swords live. And that was amazing, man. They did all the samples and everything live. That was incredible, you know? It's like, so imagine coming from a family like that, you know, and just being exposed to all this music and, you know, being the class clown and the free spirit that ODB was, he just put that into all of his music. And you can see it on his, first album. You know, he, in the middle of a track, he'll break out into Blue Moon, you know, and shit like that, which is the last thing you expect, you know? So, I could talk about Dirty for days because he's just an incredible character. But I think what really resonates with people is just that free spirit, because all of us, you know, all of us are so kind of programmed and constricted by society and what you're supposed to do and what you cannot say in public and stuff like that. All of us are under that, you know. But Dirty was not, you know. He had no rules and no editing. And even amongst the Klan, you know, it's like when they lost Dirty, I think, like, I saw Ghost in an interview, and Ghost was like, yeah, that's like losing a leg. You know, that's like, that's a huge thing for them to say, you know. That's because, like, you got to stand on your legs, you know. And if you don't have your legs, you have no support. So that's a huge thing for the guys to acknowledge about Dirty, too. And he was, you couldn't control a dude like that, which is like another thing, you know? And to me, that's Wu-Tang all the way. 'Cause it's like unpredictable, you know, the witty, unpredictable talent and natural game. ODB embodies that phrase, you know, down to every atom in his body.
The producer, you know, executive, Dante Ross, I think, has a great quote in your book, and he quotes about ODB. He says, he was a brilliant mind before substances took real control of him. He was one of the most creative minds. He really understood himself as an artist, and in all that madness, he gets portrayed as a buffoon sometimes. And I think that's like, it's easier to think of him as a buffoon than someone who was really creative and understood himself as an artist. From your interviews with his family and kind of knowing him as well, what was his ODB's thoughts about how the media had portrayed him? And did he care much? I mean, you know, there's the story about how, you know, he took the drive in the limo, right, of MTV to pick up his food stamps. But then you talk about how, like, that actually helped increase sales of his album and, you know, ended to the fantasy track with Mariah Carey and stuff like that. So what was his thoughts about how the media was portraying him?
Well, you know, I don't want to speak for Dirty or trying to get into his mind, mm-hmm. but I would say that Dirty was very aware of everything that was going on. And it's like sometimes, you know, when you're given this reputation as a crazy guy, as a madman, you kind of run with it. And one example that I will give is a man who's very much like Dirty in many ways, and he just recently passed as well. And his name is Lee Scratch Perry. Mm-hmm. You might be familiar with him because he's another amazing creative geniuses behind reggae.
Right. You know? Yep.
He taught Bob Marley how to sing, basically. And also Perry was like, you know, one of the architects and innovators of dub, you know, which is like the foundation of reggae. It's the foundation of hip hop too. And Lee Perry was also one of these guys who's thought of as just crazy because, you know, at one point he burned down his studio, the Black Ark. And by the way, he did that because there was all these people hanging out then. He was like tired of it. He was like, let's get rid of these people. But the point I want to make is that sometimes when you're given this crazy reputation, you kind of run with it, you know. And it doesn't help when you're abusing cocaine and abusing alcohol. That doesn't really help, you know. It's like that kind of feeds into the frenzy. But I think in the early days, especially like on his first album, and you know, I read Buddha Monk's book. Buddha Monk was Dirty's kind of best friend from the neighborhood and kind of like right hand man. And he talks a lot about the making of that first ODB album. And he was there pretty much every step of the way, you know. And I quote some of his stuff in the book about how, you know, Dirty would be off doing something, you know, messing with some girls or something. And he'd call in and he'd ask to hear the track that they were working on. And he would make tweaks over the phone. So this guy, you know, this guy knew exactly what was going on. And, you know, also the stunt that he pulled with MTV, you mm-hmm. know, taking a limo to pick up his welfare check or his food stamps. You know, I mean, what a brilliant idea. And it worked, you know, it got him so much attention. People who really knew Dirty, obviously his cousins knew him, RZA and GZA. Obviously the Klan knew him. Obviously Dante Ross knew him really well. People who really knew him well knew that he was this super smart, intelligent guy. At the same time, he's a free spirit, and you know everyone's calling him crazy and weird. And you know you kind of run with that. You know the ego kind of likes that and kind of runs with it. And the problem is, you know, ODB had created this character, Old Dirty Bastard. And at a certain point, he became that character, you know? And that's one of the downsides of ego, of, you know, substance abuse. But, you know, I didn't want to try to get into his mind. Because to be honest, I have never interviewed Dirty Bastard. I've met him several times and I've interacted with him several times. But we never sat down for a face-to-face interview. He's the only guy in the Klan that I never interviewed face-to-face. But I've had numerous run-ins with him, usually on the street, because I used to live in Brooklyn. I used to live not too far from his grandmother's place. And I can say about 3-4 times that I ran into him on the street just alone and just kicked it with him for a while, you know?
Right.
And it's just funny instances, you know, funny instances. I can tell you one time I was at the Source Awards, the first Source Awards, and I happened to have two all-access passes, and they were hanging on a lanyard around my neck. And I was backstage, and there was Old Dirty, and I was like, yo, what's up, man? And I was like, I live right near your grandmother on Putnam. He was like, word? And then he sees these two lanyards around my neck, and he was like, yo, dog, let me get one of those. I got people that I got to try to get in, and they ain't letting me in. Can I get one of those? And I was like, for sure, man. And I gave him one of my lanyards to get one of his people in. And he was just like so appreciative. It was like, oh, peace, brother. I was like, and I called him Ason at the time. I was like, no problem, Ason, anytime, brother. And, you know, that's the type of guy he was. Like, even though he was like crazy, you know, he had this reputation and this kind of image of being crazy. If you talk to him one-on-one, he was a completely cool guy, completely down to earth. And, I've heard that from so many people, like, and especially like people in Brooklyn, you know, he used to stop his BMW at traffic lights, get out and just go hand out money to people, you know, cause he loved his community. He loved Brooklyn. He was like the number one Brooklyn representative. And I remember like when his album came out, it's like you could feel it on the streets of Brooklyn. You could feel the pride. You know, it's like you hear that album blasting all over the place in Brooklyn. And, you know, his community gave him love right back, you know, people tried to rob him and stuff. He was much loved in the community. And, you know, he just kept it real. He kept it 100% real, you know. And in the book, I don't attempt to go inside his mind, but I wanted to show, you know, kind of his downward spiral and how it actually occurred, because it didn't really have to happen that way, you know. And, you know, it's a substance abuse, but you know, behind all of that, he was just like a highly intelligent dude and just a 100% authentic dude and just good natured, down to earth. And you know, I can't say enough good things about him. You know, that's what we have to remember him for. You know, we shouldn't remember him for his last concert, you know, when he's, you know, high on crack or whatever he was into at the time. You know, that's, you know, unfortunately drugs take out a lot of entertainers, you know. I mean, look at the whole history of music. Look how drugs have just totally taken out entertainers, and there's very few people who can get past that, you know. Even like a genius, a legend like John Coltrane was a heroin addict for a while, you know. He was able to get over it, and that's when he entered his real spiritual phase, you know. And but that takes a really special person, and really when you're on drugs to that extent, you really need outside help, you know. And I obviously, you know, even though ODB was in rehab and stuff like that, he wasn't getting the help and the support that he needed, you know. So it is what it is, but we should remember him for the free spirit that he was and the intelligent guy that he was, because pulling off stunts like that MTV stunt was just pure genius, man. That was just pure genius.
And that's kind of like, I mean, the real I mean, I think that a big takeaway from this book is that there is this, I said it before, but like there is this entrepreneurial genius behind all of them. Like, you know, it's like every move seems very calculated, what they're doing, whether we know it or not.
Exactly. You know, exactly. And you, and you know, you got to credit RZA too. You got, you know, I mean, RZA, you know, I talked about how they used to sell newspapers at the Verrazano Bridge and stuff like that, how he used to shovel snow. You know, I used to be a kid like that too, because like when you grow up poor, you kind of have to do that. You know, it's like no one's giving you shit. You gotta go out and make stuff happen for yourself, you know? And all of these guys, you know, come from that mentality. You know, unfortunately, they grew up in a neighborhood where the easiest opportunity to make money was the crack game, you know? So eventually all of them got into that. But now look at them, you know, now look at all the entrepreneurial stuff that they're doing. Raekwon has his own wine, his own brand of wine. You know, Meth is doing like weed. You know, they all have other things going on, which is important, you know, because we all know that this music thing, you know, it can only last a certain amount. It's like, you know, but even that, you know, they're all in their 50s now and they're still doing shows and stuff like that. They can do that, you know, because they are Wu-Tang. And we still want to see them perform. We still want to see them tour. We still want to see them make albums. You know, we're the fans like myself. I'm just a fan at the end of the day. You know, even though I had ridiculous access to them back in the day, let me tell you, man, I'm still a fan. And when I'm sitting with them all in one room in L.A., you know, watching Kung Fu flicks, I was like, I had to pinch myself. I was like, damn. Am I really here? You know, because you, when you're around them like that, they're just real down to earth brothers, and you know, it's not. This was back in the day, back in the 90s. You know, I don't know how they are now. Maybe it's gone to their heads and stuff like that. But all really down to earth and very cool people to be hanging out with, and the type of dudes that you would want to have a beer with, you know, and just kick it. So I was just lucky to be that fan who had that extra access, and that's why I went into journalism in the first place, just to meet all the people that I wanted to meet, you know, because I'm really into music, and you know, journalism has allowed me to do that, you know.
I want to ask you about two, I think, really, in terms of two significant, business events, right, that the clan did. And that's talk about the RZA creating this deal for the group, mm-hmm. you know, record deal for the group without locking in individual members to this deal. And kind of the significance of that, especially at that time, and how he was able to, I guess, command that kind of deal, right? I mean, first time artist, you know, you don't right. you just think of that. You're like, how does someone do that? And then also, if you could talk about, you know, 2015, this continued outside the box mentality that Wu has, where they, you know, they pretty much made a record in secret, auctioned off at like highest bidder, and they, you know, world's most expensive album, right?
Right.
How do you think that came to play, or how did they just come up with something like that, knowing full well that they're at a time in their career that they could do something like that?
Okay. Okay, well, for the first part of your question, as far as the unprecedented deal that RZA got, you got to remember that RZA had already been burned in the industry once. You know, he had been signed to Tommy Boy as a solo artist, and he got totally jerked. And, you know, GZA, same thing with GZA. You know, he had been signed to Cold Chillin', and they didn't really promote his stuff, and they didn't really represent him how he wanted to be represented. So RZA especially had a chip on his shoulder, and he was like, you know, this is not going to happen to me again. You know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. So that was not going to happen to him again. And the way he was able to get that deal, though, has just as much to do with Steve Rifkin. You know, I think Rifkin was just like an equal player in making that happen, because, you know, I go into some of Rifkin's background too. You know, he comes from a music industry family. His dad and his grandfather, you know, were deep in the industry. And Rifkin was trying to create his own opportunity. You know, he wanted to make it in his own right. So he had this new label called Loud. And when RZA approached, you know, he had been trying to track down RZA, you know, for weeks after he had heard Protect Your Neck. And then when he finally did connect with RZA, you know, they're I think they're almost the same age too. So you're dealing with, you know, someone who's kind of like your equal, you know. And RZA approached him as a businessman. And he said, I want this, this, and this. Because because RZA knew how the music industry worked. You know, he knew that the deals are not favorable to artists. But here in Rifkin, you had a guy who's just as hungry as he is, who's starting a new label. So he's thinking, all right, I'm gonna make a compromise. And it was a risk at the time. I'm going to not take as much money up front, but in exchange for that, you have to give me the stuff that I want. You know, this is what he's telling Steve Rifkin. And what you have to give me is, first of all, full creative control on the music. You can't tell me what to do on the music. And secondly, I know that the money that you give me is not going to support all these nine guys that I got to look out for. So you got to give me the opportunity to shop these guys a deal with other labels, because I can see that you don't have the money that I'm looking for. And that was a big risk, you know, because like, RZA could have made a record, it could have gone nowhere, and they would have gotten 60 grand out of it, you know, half of which they spent on making the record, and they could have gone all back to the street again. So that was a big risk he took. But at the same time, he knew the talent that he was sitting on. You know, he knew what he had. He was operating from his position of power. Even though he's a young guy, his genius was knowing that I got something. I got some shit here, you know? So that was RZA's genius as a young man, to know that, listen, I have power here. It's almost like Muhammad Ali. When Muhammad Ali was coming up, you know, here's this shit-talking dude from Kentucky who's only like 20 years old, and he's got this big ass mouth. He's running his mouth. He's talking about, oh, I'm going to take on Floyd Patterson. I'm going to take on, what's his name? I can't even know.
Liston.
Sonny Liston. You know, he's talking shit about these guys. Have you seen that PBS documentary, by the way? It was just on Sunday, but it's great. It's great. People should watch that, because I see RZA as a young Muhammad Ali. You know, he knows the power that he's got, and he's taken all on these big guys, and he's challenging them. So he approached Steve Rifkin from a position of power. And even though he was taking a risk, he eventually won out, you know, as we see, as history has proven. And every deal that RZA negotiated, and the one of the great ones was Raekwon, because, you know, at that point, you know, RCA was trying to nickel and dime him and downplay him. And I talk about the whole story in the book about, you know, there was only a 20 grand difference between what RCA was offering and what RZA wanted. But because Method Man's album was blowing up, because Dirty's album was blowing up, they eventually had to pay Raekwon $500,000 for that first album, which was a lot more than they had planned to pay him. So as you keep on negotiating these bigger deals, you get more and more power, you know. So RZA in the mid 90s, you couldn't touch him. He was a giant. And all of these dudes like Puffy and Jay-Z, they saw what he was doing and they were inspired by what he was doing. Cause at that time, no artists were commanding deals like that. You know, you couldn't get deals like that, you know. And now it's almost like people take it for granted, but let's be honest, man, Puffy, you know, started blowing up in the late 90s, and Jay-Z after that. And those guys benefited heavily from what RZA was doing, you know. And, you know, a contemporary of RZA is Dr. Dre. You know, Dr. Dre, same thing. You know, he knows the power that he has. And he's been able to parlay that power into some serious deals, you know. And now if you want to jump to 2015 with this one-off Wu-Tang album, Once Upon a Time in Shaolin, that was another masterful stroke by RZA, you know, because he didn't really have to do anything, because you know, this guy Silver Rings kind of spearheaded the whole project. And it was kind of Silver Ring's whole idea to begin with, you know, for this one-off idea. And it is a brilliant idea, you know, to sell music like fine art, you know, like to sell an album as if it's a Basquiat piece, you know, or Rembrandt, or, you know, but, you know, RZA had this relationship with Silver Rings, which I go into in the book. And, you know, Silver Rings eventually ends up going on tour with RZA, you know, when RZA was doing Bobby Digital, the solo thing. And Silver Rings opened up for RZA on that tour. So they became friends, and they became tight. So that, you know, Silver Rings is talking about all these ideas he's got. And one of them was for that one-off album. And I think it's a brilliant idea. I just wish RZA had produced the album, you know, because at the end of the day, Silver Rings is the guy who produced off all the beats on that album. And that's why all the Klan is kind of mad at him, because he kind of kept it secretive from them too. You know, he didn't really tell them what this was going to be for. And then it all came out after the fact. But the way that they marketed that album was just, you know, they auctioned it off, and it's an incredible story. And I think, you know, there's a book about that there's a book about that whole incident. And it just goes to show, you know, even like years later, the power that Wu-Tang has in this industry. I mean, what other group could auction off one of their albums for $2 million, you know, to the highest bidder? I don't think even Dr. Dre could pull that off, you know, and he's probably the only guy on that level of the music and the business who could pull something like that off. And, you know, Wu-Tang was able to do that. And I just wish that, you know, like I said, that RZA had produced that album, because then, you know, it would be, I think especially the fans would be so much more amped about it. And, you know, there's nothing preventing Wu-Tang right now from getting together and making an album with RZA producing the beats and doing like a throwback style album. You know, I don't know what's preventing them. Well, I'll tell you what's preventing them now, because they all now have individual management. And, you know, when it gets into the money of the shit, it's all messed up. You know, it's like, even getting together for the smallest thing, now they got like 9 different managers that have to come together and, you know, negotiate stuff. Where before it was just Wu-Tang management, which was divine. You know, I guess that didn't work out for the guys, so they had to get, you know, they had to break away. But artistically speaking, there's nothing that is preventing Wu-Tang from doing another album the way the fans would like it done, you know, with RZA handling most of the production. Because I know he's got beats. I know he's got tons of material, you know, even from back in the day. He wouldn't even have to do new stuff. Imagine if RZA found like a shoebox of floppy disks that he had done in like 95 that no one's ever heard. Because let me tell you, every time I've been with RZA and he plays me beats, I've never heard any of those. Well, I've heard some, but a lot of that stuff I've never heard on Wu-Tang albums. And that shit is just like, whoa. That's just like, if people could hear that shit, like vintage Wu-Tang shit, it would be over, you know, it would be over. So they could do that. They could do that right now, you know. And RZA, if you're listening, man, guys, if you're listening, man, this is, you know, this is what the fans want, man. Why don't you guys do it? You wouldn't have to sell one-off copies. You could sell millions of copies of that record.
People said his brain was infected by devils. My father would come home. He'd forget about the killings. He wasn't scared of the Shogun, but the Shogun was scared of him. Maybe that was the problem. Then, one night, the Shogun sent his ninja spies to our house. They were supposed to kill my father, but they didn't.
Sometimes you gotta fast and fast. You niggas don't know where this shit started. Y'all know where it came from.
You've obviously have had these incredible opportunities to, and you talk about it, you know, sit in studio sessions while the individual members are making albums. And, you know, it's like, I always like to ask the artist, like, if you could be a fly in the wall at like a setting, you know, of a record, where would you, like, what album would you want to be on, or, you know, or listen to being made? And you've been able to be this fly in the wall during these albums. And I want to ask you about your story about being pulled in for a skit during Jizz's album, Liquid Swords. How did that happen?
That's what I'd like to know. Well, first of all, I at that time I was like writing for Rolling Stone, so I asked my editor, you know, if I could review. I knew that Jizz's album was coming out, so I asked him if I could do a review of Jizz's album. So just that excuse, you know, to write a review about an album, I parlayed into spending like several days with Wu-Tang while they were working on that album. You know, I went to a couple studio sessions. I hung out with Jizza a couple times. I remember smoking a blunt in his car with him once, and we had a crazy talk about conspiracy shit. And you know, we were talking about the movie They Live with Rowdy Roddy Piper. And, you know, these guys are like up on all this crazy information. I think the first time I ever heard about the Illuminati was from Jizza, you know, and this was before Illuminati was such a common word, a common thing in hip hop. But anyway, I was writing for Rolling Stone, so I parlayed doing a review into basically spending several days with them. And one of those days happened to be the mastering session when they're finally putting the whole album together. The mastering session is where basically you take all the finished tracks and you equalize them. You get them all sounding nice and crisp. And that's the last step before it's sent off to the pressing plant. So that night it happened to be, it would happen to be myself, RZA, Jizza, Killer Priest, Master Killa, and Dreddy Krueger in the mastering suite at Sterling Sound in Manhattan. And they had finished mastering the tracks. And then RZA was like, oh man, we need some skits for this album. We need some, you know, supplementary material, because basically if you know Wu-Tang albums, it's never just music. You know, there's skits in between the songs, there's little snippets of movies and stuff like that. And I think RZA had been so busy working on all this other stuff that he didn't have time to get that all that shit together. So he was doing this at the very last minute in the mastering session. So the first thing he does is send out the studio engineer out to the Deuce, which is Times Square, to get this movie, Shogun Assassin on VHS. I had never seen the movie. I had never heard of it. It's actually a Japanese samurai flick, and it is one of the most violent movies you will ever see. And the assistant came back with the VHS, so we hooked up the VHS and we end up watching the whole movie, which is like an hour and a half. And you know, meanwhile they're paying for the room. You know, it costs $350 an hour to even be in this room, and meanwhile they're watching this whole freaking kung fu movie, which I know they had seen many times before. And it's like I said, the only thing that was missing was the popcorn. Everyone's kind of like sprawled out on the couches and they're like laughing at these things, and it's just like over the top violence. I was like, damn, this shit is like so over the top violent. It's like the guy, the main character, the samurai, cuts off someone's head with one swipe of his sword. And it's like a fountain of blood spurting, you know, it's like, shh. And that's where they got all of the snippets for Liquid Swords, the little kid talking. That was the son of the samurai. You know, when my father was young, when I was young, my father was a samurai. All of those snippets came from that movie. So anyway, we finished watching the movie. Then we pull out, it took longer than an hour and a half to watch the movie, because when RZA sees a snippet that he likes, he stops the movie. You know, we rewind it, we record it from VHS into the mastering guy's DAT or whatever. So it took probably like 3 hours to watch the movie. Then after that, he's like, oh man, we need some more skits for this album. And, you know, I'm sitting there the whole time. I'm just I'm just like a fly on the wall. I'm watching the whole shit. These guys are not paying any attention to me. I'm just, you know, kind of watching. And then he was like, and then RZA remembered that I had been on a skit on the Gravediggers, because I was friends with Prince Paul at the time. In fact, you know, back then I used to run an independent label called Word Sound, and I had put out Prince Paul's first solo album called Psychoanalysis, which was basically instrumental album of beats and skits. And so that's how I got to be friends with Prince Paul. And then when Prince Paul was doing Gravediggers, he called me and he invited me to come down to Firehouse because he needed me to read this part for a skit. So I played the crooked lawyer on a song called Diary of a Madman from Gravediggers' first album. And that was actually the first time I had met RZA in the flesh. I had spoken to RZA on the phone before, but that was the first time I actually met him. So he was there when I recorded that skit from Diary of a Madman. I was playing the crooked lawyer. I was like, yo, fellas, the judge is my uncle. He'll take the insanity plea. Don't worry. So RZA remembered me from that time. And then when he's in this mastering session for Liquid Swords, he's like, yo, we need to do some skits. And he was like, Skiz, I want you to play a drug dealer. Just follow my lead. And I was like, all right, what am I supposed to say? He said, just follow my lead. Just say, do you have the cash and all that shit? And so RZA's got the portable DAT and he's acting out this drug deal. And I play this drug dealer called Mr. Greco, and this is on the skit that precedes Killer Hills 10304. So Riz is like, Mr. Greco, which is me. And I'm like, do you have the cash, $20,000? And Riz is like, yeah, we got the cash. We know cash rules everything around this motherfucker. And basically, in the skit, if you listen to the album, you know, it's a drug deal going bad. Like one of Greco's people has like sold him out. And Riz is like acting out this skit and all the other guys are around him. Master Killer, Killer Priest, Dreddy Krueger. I don't think GZA was there at the time. So like they're all crowding around me and RZA grabs me by the neck and he's like, you know, he's like screaming at me and he's like, your friend Don and Rodriguez is singing his ass off like a fucking bird. And he's screaming at me and all the other guys are like crowding around me. And I literally at that point thought that I was going to get punched or something because I didn't know these guys. You know, I didn't know these other guys. I knew RZA and GZA. I didn't know. I knew Master Killer by reputation because he was in the news for punching out a friend of mine, Chao Coker, who was a journalist who had written an article about Wu-Tang and Rap Pages. And Master Killer didn't like the artwork that had accompanied that album, the article. So he approached Chao, and Chao had nothing to do with it, but Chao got a black eye out of it, you know? So I had heard about Master Killer, but I had never met him. And here's this like silent dude, you know, he's like never said a word the whole time. And now he's like all up in my face. And Riz is like grabbing me by the neck. And literally, I literally thought that I was going to get beat up. And let me tell you, nothing happened. We recorded the skit in one take and that was it. And I didn't even know it was going to even come out on the album. Because I would have wanted to do it again because I didn't really like my accent. I was like trying to put on a foreign accent and I didn't really like it. But it appeared on the final album, which is like, wow. And let me tell you, later that night, that mastering session went on for hours. And I heard, because I had a friend who worked at Sterling Sound, this guy, John Ward. And I heard that like later that night when Wu-Tang were leaving, like there was a problem with the elevator and Master Killer ends up punching out the security guard at Sterling Sound because the elevator didn't show up on time. So I feel like I dodged a bullet that night, and I had a good story to tell, you know, after that. And I didn't really tell people this. I told a few of my friends about that. So, you know, this story didn't really come out till now, but it's all peace. You know, it's like every time I see Master Killer, he always like looks, smiles at me. He's like, "Oh, Mr. Greco." So we always have that kind of inside joke, you know. And it was, you know, it was a fun thing to do. And it was like, to me, it just kind of shows how Wu-Tang operates, you know, like the level of creativity that they operate on. Basically, anything goes. And, you know, with RZA, anything goes. And, you know, nothing is out of limits, you know. And it's like that's like the level of creativity that they operate on. And shit is spontaneous, you know, accidents happen. And that's all a part of how they operate, you know.
Is there an album that you didn't get to sit in on by the Clan or even individuals that you when you first heard it, you're like, damn, I wish I was able to sit on this album?
Well, you know, a lot of times, I would go to 36 Chambers in Manhattan, and you didn't even know what album they were working on. You know, like different days there'd be different dudes in the studio. I don't think I ever sat in on one of Ghost's tracks on Iron Man. Yeah, because, you know, like Ghost was in prison for half that time. Yeah, I think Ghost was in prison. He was on Rikers for like 4 months during the recording of that album. And, you know, they recorded half of it before he went in, and then he was in prison, and then they recorded the rest when he came out. And I would have loved to be around like after he came out, because you know that stint in Rikers had an effect on him, I think in interviews, like he was writing the stuff, he was writing to no beats basically when he was locked up, you know. So I think that's where a lot of that stream of consciousness flow maybe came from, you know. And also, you know, Ghost was a diabetic, and at one point he went to Africa. He went to, I think it was, it's in the book. I kind of forget. I think it was like Sierra Leone. But he went to Africa to see a bush doctor, and, you know, to get some natural cure for the diabetes. And once again, when he was in Africa, he didn't have like a boom box to write to, you know, so he was just freestyling basically poetry. And I think that's where he developed this crazy, insane stream of consciousness flows. Because to me, Ghost lyrics are like the most inscrutable of all of the Clan. You know, it's like you're trying to figure out what he's talking about. And, you know, sometimes it makes sense, sometimes it doesn't, you know, but it all sounds dope, you know, whatever he's talking about, it all sounds dope. And I think that's, you know, that's an album that I would love to be on. I would love to be around during Dirty's album, that first album, because even RZA wasn't around for much of that. You know, he kind of let Dirty do his thing, and Dirty took like 2 years to work on that album, you know. But you get a lot of information from Buddha Monk, who was around for the making of that, you know. But man, that must have been a crazy album to be working on, you know, because I remember, you know, at one point Dirty's wife comes into the vocal booth, and he gets her to recreate an argument that they had, you know, about groupies calling the house. So, you know, it's just crazy, like the stuff that they that you know their creative approach to recording albums is certainly unlike any other rapper or hip hop artist that I've ever been around. And I've been in the studio with plenty of artists. You know, I've been in the studio with plenty of artists. I was around for Mobb Deep's The Infamous album. I was up in Unique when they were recording that album. You know, I've been in the studio with Busta Rhymes, who's an incredible artist to see how he works and how he operates. And so I've been around for plenty of studio sessions, EPMD, but I've never seen dudes operate like Wu-Tang. I've never seen dudes operate like that, and the dedication. And, you know, especially when they had, you know, they had a few different iterations of 36 Chambers. And one was when they had the Wu Mansion in New Jersey. And that was when they could basically work 24/7, 365. You know, they didn't have to pay for studio time or anything. And I remember being in there once and like I had a video camera. And I was like crawling around behind the board, and I was getting like dirty looks from Meth, who was like writing his rhyme. And I was filming Raekwon while he was in the vocal booth, and Raekwon was like, "Oh, niggas got video cameras now and shit." You know, I was always like very self-conscious because I don't like to draw attention to myself when I'm around people, especially when they're creating. You know, so I try to kind of fade into the background, but when you have a video camera, it's kind of hard to do that. And I wish I had a video camera more during that time, because I could have captured some incredible shit. I've been in the studio with RZA and Bjork.
Holy shit! Wow,
that was like some incredible shit. I didn't really talk about a lot of that stuff in the book, you know, because I don't even know what happened to that stuff that RZA did with Bjork, if it even came out. But my man Scotty Hard was the engineer for that session, so that's why I was able to get in there. But I do remember that they had the New York Philharmonic string section in there, and RZA was getting them to play some of the violin lines that he had played on keyboard, and that was hilarious to watch RZA directing the New York Philharmonic string section, man. That was some hilarious shit, you know. But I'm just lucky to have been around, and I hope I communicated some of that in the book, because section two of the book, which is Bring the Ruckus, I go in depth on all the first round of solo albums. And, you know, through the majority of the book, I tried to keep myself out of it, because I hate to read stuff. You know, that was kind of big that was a big thing in The Source back in the day. Like the journalists would always put themselves in the article. And it was like, "Oh, look at me. I'm smoking a blunt with Snoop Dogg on the bus and stuff." And, you know, I did that to a certain extent, but I didn't like to do that, you know, especially with this book. I wanted to keep myself out of it, because I'm not trying to big up myself. I wanted to show what these guys were doing. But hopefully I communicated some of that flavor of what it's like to be in the studio with them without putting myself in it. I told that GZA story just in the preface. That's the only time in the book that I use first person. But for the rest of the book, I pretty much kept myself out of it, you know, even though I was kind of like the omniscient narrator throughout the whole book, you know, because I want the book to read like a story, like a page turner novel that you don't want to put down, you know. It could have easily been like an oral history, but to me that would have been the lazy way out, because, you know, I already have like 100 pages of quotes from all the Wu-Tang guys. I've interviewed all of them multiple times, and I could have just taken those quotes and, you know, kind of structure them. But to me, the important part of the book is the context that I offer, you know. And the book is just is as much about hip hop as it's as much about New York City as Wu-Tang. Wu-Tang is almost like the focus, but I talk about a lot of other stuff, you know, that's related to Wu-Tang. I talk about the history of the 5% Nation, which is to me is like super interesting. You know, it's like, how did this fringe group originate and how did they come to influence so many rappers, you know, and what is their philosophy all about, you know? And, you know, I talked about the whole cocaine business, the whole crack industry, and like how, you know, how that all originated, and, you know, where it came from and how that influenced hip hop, and you know, what the movie Scarface had to do with it, you know. And I go deep into all the kung fu movies that influenced the Klan, and, you know, the philosophy, the, you know, I think one reason that I got along so well with RZA is because I'm originally from Sri Lanka, and I think 74% of Sri Lankans are Buddhist, you know, and Buddhism is not a religion. It's really a philosophy. It's a way of life. And I think early on I had told RZA that I'm Buddhist, you know, and he was obviously very into Buddhism and just spirituality in general. And he was always, anytime I saw him, he was always reading books about different things. And, you know, I would talk to him about Buddhism sometimes. So I think that's why I always had a good rapport with him. And, you know, GZA too, these guys can talk about so many other things than just music. You know, and you look at GZA now, he does talks on science. You know, he's hooked up with Neil deGrasse Tyson, and he goes to universities and does lectures. You know, these guys are real smart dudes. And I think that's what really attracted me to them in the first place, was because they were so different than any rapper that I had encountered up to that point, you know. Even though they were like serious hood dudes, they had this other dimension to them, this intelligence and this wisdom that you don't find in people who come from nothing, and, you know, who are kind of trapped in this environment. They were always seeking knowledge and seeking wisdom. And I think, you know, the 5% influence had a huge, had a lot to do with that. So, you know, that's why I always respect these guys, because they were so far above anyone else at the time. And I think to a certain extent, they still are, you know, and that's why they're still around. And that's why they're still relevant. And that's why people are still interested in Wu-Tang Clan. So I just wanted to, you know, writing the book, I just wanted to let people know, you know, what these guys are really all about. Because it's not just music, you know, it's not just music at all. There's so much more to music than that Wu-Tang has to offer. And because I had such a... because I was lucky enough to have such a perspective on them, I wanted to share this perspective with other people, you know, because at the end of the day, I'm a huge fan myself, and I know that other fans are going to be interested in this stuff as much as I am. At the same time, I want someone like my mom to appreciate Wu-Tang, you know. I want my mom to understand why I spent so much time, you know, bothering with this thing called hip hop. You know, for her, it's all about violence and all this stuff and what the media portrays. But hip hop is a very deep culture with deep roots, you know, and it's got a deep philosophy. You know, to me, it's like, it's on par with Rastafarianism. You know, like I talk about that, you know, how Rastafarianism has influenced reggae, You got stuff like 5% influencing hip hop. So it's more than just music. It's more than just a pop phenomenon. Hip hop will always be a culture with deep roots. And, you know, it's a way of life. It's a philosophy that people live. Because of that, it will never really die. You know, it'll just continue to evolve.
And I think, you know, I think this is earlier, but like you do that, you said this in the book. I feel talking about each member's childhood and then going into the selling newspapers or shoveling snow and essentially leaving like Brownsville, right? Because Rizzo was like, I don't want to get robbed. you know, like the idea that like, well, he was probably robbed, you know, like it kind of puts that line to be like, no, I mean, these guys are, and there's a lot of guys that are trying to get out and they don't want to be part of a gang life, or they don't want to go around robbing people. They're trying to figure out ways to get out. And then obviously reading up on, you know, how they've pretty much managed through the music industry and expanded themselves into other parts of other cultures or other forms of business, right? It's fascinating to it's kind of those I wish I had just like something like, you know, wires that I could connect to each member's brain and figure out how the hell they think. Because it'd be wonderful to just understand how these guys think and constantly thinking to make something better for what they need.
Exactly. You know, I wish I did too. Because you know, it's very difficult to get people to talk about their childhood and what they came from, because there's a lot of trauma in the past. You know, and I think it's good. I think that's good. I think it's a really great thing that all of the guys are eventually going to write their own books. You know, like You God's book Raw is just phenomenal. You know, the way he talks about how he got into the whole crack game and everything. And, you know, obviously RZA has written a couple books about his childhood and where he came from and how that's influenced him. And you got to be incredibly strong to survive all that, you know. I mean, and it makes someone, you know, I grew up poor too, but I didn't see someone get shot when I was 5 years old, or I don't have that trauma, you know. But I did spend time in Iraq during the war, you know, like in 2003. And when you're around that type of violence, it's not a pretty thing, you know, and it's not something that you want to glorify at all. It's something that you want to escape. And, you know, it's something that leads to trauma, you know, and most of these guys living in, you know, what we call the ghetto or the hood or low budget environments, they're trying to get out of there. You know, they don't want to stay there. Most of the people in the projects are trying to get out of the projects, you know. These are all decent people who are just trying to live, you know, and mm-hmm. they don't have the opportunity, or they don't have the luck that other people have, or the opportunities. So, you know, you got to give it up for people like Wu-Tang, who made their own opportunities, you know, made their own legal opportunities. And that takes a special kind of person. And really, to me, their whole story is inspirational for anyone, you know. And I take their story to heart for myself, because, you know, no matter what I've been through in life, these guys have gone through 10 times worse, and they made it, you know. So why can't I do what I want to do? Why can't I, you know, make it on my own terms? You know, that's the message of Wu-Tang and the message of this whole book. You know, it's like, no matter where you come from, or, you know, or what life, or, you know, what life is handed to you, it doesn't really matter, because you can use your mind and your intellect to advance yourself and to elevate yourself and to you know, do exactly what you want to do in life. You know, you don't have to be controlled by the system. You don't have to be manipulated by the man. You can do whatever you want, you know? And it's like Wu-Tang, you had like nine brothers who joined together for a common cause. And really, on the outside, that common cause was to make music. But on the inside, that common cause was to escape hell for themselves and their family, get out of hell. And they have done that in spades. You know, they have done that for themselves and their families. And they have laid down a blueprint for everyone else to follow, for rappers to follow, for anyone else who's in a bad situation to follow. You know, I mean, imagine RZA on trial for attempted murder. Imagine getting out of that. Imagine like going on the stand to defend yourself and being able to come through that. You know, that's probably so empowering, you know, to be able to do something like that and then to turn it into a positive, you know, and now to do what they've done now, it's just like, wow, you know, if they can do it, anyone can do it. That's the message that I take from the book. And that's why I kind of laid it out like that, you know, because these guys came from nothing and look where they are today. You know, if they can do it, you can do it.
Excuse me, I have one more question. You know, you think of, you've written this book, From the Streets of Shaolin, the Wu-Tang Saga, and just as a pure fan, if you were to give an opening track for your book and then a closing track for your book by either Wu-Tang, the clan, or an individual member, what would those two tracks be?
I think the opening track would be Bring the Ruckus. And that's really what I wanted to call the book, quite frankly, Bring the Ruckus, because that's what they brought. You know, Wu-Tang kind of surprised us all. You know, they kind of shook up the whole industry, and not even just the music industry. They shook up the world, you know, because their music, their lyrics were just unprecedented for rap music, for hip hop. And they really did bring a revolution, you know. And like I said, you know, it is all possible. It is possible, you know, all things are possible. And for the ending of the book, I would probably do Can It All Be So Simple, because when it comes down to it, it really is that simple. You know, you just have to have an idea and be prepared to do whatever it takes to execute that idea, and you can manifest things out of thin air. Which is what Wu-Tang has done. They created a movement. They created, you know, tangible things for themselves and their family. And their idea is an idea that's time has arrived, you know. It's like, F all the bullshit, F all the excuses, you know. You as an individual have the power to achieve and attain what you want to do. So let's all focus on that and let's do it.
The name of the book is From the Streets of Shaolin, the Wu-Tang Saga. The author is Skids Fernando. Skids, thank you so much for being on Library Rock, the Hip Hop Interviews with Tim Vitacola. I really appreciate your time.
Hey, respect, Tim. Thanks for the venue. Now I'm a weed fiend, jetting the palm metal. Hit Medina, yo, no doubt. The dog got crazy clout, pushing a big joint from down south. So if you're filthy stacked up, better watch your back and duck, because these fiends, they got it cracked up. Now my man from up north, now he got the law. As solid as a rock and crazy saw. No jokes, I'm not playing. Get his folks, Desert Eagle is dick, and put him in a yoke. And the note for sure, I got wreck and rip shot. I pointed again at his mother's knife.